Now, I would like to take the opportunity to introduce our first panel to discuss capping or standardizing trailing commissions. Our panelists are Warren Collier, Managing Director and Head of Canada iShares at BlackRock Asset Management, Scott Finley, President and Chair of the Board of Directors at Independent Financial Brokers of Canada, Neil Gross, the President of Component Strategies Consulting, Nicole Lee, Assistant General Counsel at RBC, and Robert Strickland, President of Fidelity Investments Canada. So introducing the background for this panel, Chantel will start.
So for each of the topics we'll be discussing here today, I'll be giving you some background, including a flavor of what we heard through the comment process on the paper, which will help to lend some context to the questions that we'll be asking our panelists. So I'll start with topic one. So one of the primary concerns that the CSA has identified with embedded commissions, and in particular trailing commissions, is that these types of payments raise conflicts of interest that misalign the interests of investment fund managers and of dealers and their representatives with those of their clients. Specifically, we are concerned that trailing commissions give rise to compensation incentives that can skew the advice of dealers and their representatives towards products that maximize their compensation or cause them to only look at products that pay a certain level of commissions at the expense of their clients' interests. We're also concerned that trailing commissions can incent investment fund managers to rely more on payments to dealers rather than on product quality and price to gather and preserve assets under management. These conflicts together do not foster an environment conducive to the growth of lower cost products, including investment funds that don't pay trailing commissions. This raises investor protection and market efficiency concerns, which have brought us to consider whether trailing commission payments should be prohibited altogether. But what has been made very clear by industry stakeholders during the consultation process is that the threat of negative unintended consequences resulting from an outright ban is very real. For example, it's been consistently argued that a ban could lead to less access to advice among mass market investors and higher advice costs. It's also been argued that a ban may have the effect of creating a material competitive advantage for large vertically integrated firms, which we find already dominate the market, over small and independent providers, because such large firms have the ability to cross-subsidize internally by reallocating costs and revenue streams across a range of business lines. We're told that internal transfer payments by vertically integrated firms to their affiliated dealer may allow them to circumvent a prohibition on embedded commissions. We're told this will further drive demand towards proprietary funds and away from third-party funds, leading to greater concentration in the marketplace, which will in turn lead to less product choice and reduce competition. The possibility for these consequences to materialize has us concerned because they don't foster positive outcomes for investors. Many industry stakeholders propose that instead of an outright ban, the CSA should consider capping or standardizing trailing commissions. So we'll focus this discussion on how, if at all, these alternatives of capping or standardizing can mitigate the conflict of interest and lead to a better result for investors. Capping, just so you know the difference between capping and standardizing, capping would involve setting a maximum rate on trailing commissions, below which investment fund managers could choose to pay a lesser rate, whereas standardizing would involve prescribing a specific rate with no flexibility for investment fund managers that pay trailers to pay more or less than the prescribed rate. In either case, capping or standardizing, we would consider whether the rate should be the same across all asset classes or differ by asset class. These potential alternatives, however, leave open a few questions. And with that, I'll pass it off to Maureen to ask questions to our panelists and moderate the discussion.
Okay, so we'll start off first addressing the issue with conflicts of interest, and Warren put his hand up to start. What we'll do is I'll direct the question at one individual, and then we'll have a discussion with the panel after. So first of all, as discussed, the CSA is concerned about the conflicts of interest. So given these alternative proposals of capping or standardizing that would allow the commissions to persist, explain how the conflict of interest associated with trailing commissions can affect be effectively addressed so that dealers, representatives, and IFMs are not incented by trailing commissions and are focused on getting the best investor outcomes? And also, could you just explain if you think one or the other proposal is better to address?
Perfect. Thanks very much, Maureen. And thank you to my fellow panelists. You will definitely hear a diverse set of views up here, I think, and this is a, I think it's a very important step in getting to the right outcome here. So I thank you for including us, and thank you all for joining us today and for the active engagement many of you have demonstrated around this issue for years. I think the OSC and Chantal right now, you have articulated very clearly the concerns that we continue to see with either capping or standardizing trail commissions as an alternative to banning. The onus is on us in the industry to prove that either of these alternatives will get us to an outcome from an investor's perspective and a market efficiency perspective that is better than an outright ban would be. To date, in the written submissions, I haven't seen anything that gets us there. The fact is that trail commissions give rise to incentives that need to be managed. Capping and standardizing could both involve asking a securities regulator to get involved in the game of price setting, something for which you neither have a mandate nor expertise. To me, that seems like a recipe for a more complicated, more burdensome regulatory oversight regime for us, and mandate for you, and it doesn't, again, as I'll get to it in a second, I think, address all of the underlying conflicts. There are five reasons that I don't think this works. First, both standardized and or capped commissions would be incredibly blunt hammers for the personalized, nuanced, and changing circumstances of investors that advisors are looking after day to day. A mandated one-size-fits-all solution is really a step backwards from where we already are today, I would think. You look today at the fact that there are still, notwithstanding significant progress on this issue within the industry, do-it-yourself investors paying trail commissions non-commensurate with the administrative costs of the services their dealers providing. We would be taking that issue and making it worse, I would argue. Further, standardizing across the industry could potentially, and capping would very likely, lead to an increase in fees paid by some or all investors. The research across industries demonstrates that the outcome over time of capping prices in an industry is that fees rise to that capped price. Standardizing would not necessarily give rise to that issue, but unless all funds across all segments were standardized at the lowest fee level, it would give rise to a fee increase for some. That being said, if all market participants were organized the same way and had the same economic models, you could argue, and I would argue, that standardizing commissions would go some way to ameliorating the conflict faced by advisors in choosing which product to use when there are varying fee levels between like products. The reality is, however, we don't have a standard market structure. We have large, vertically integrated firms, and we have small independent firms. Their models are very different, and I worry that any of these alternatives would be much easier to manage in a non-harmful way by the larger vertically integrated firms than the independent firms. I don't think any of us wants to see a decrease in competition in this market. Finally, and I'll wrap on this, neither capping nor standardizing does anything, it doesn't even pretend to do anything, about the conflict an advisor faces in deciding whether to keep a client invested in a trail commission paying mutual fund versus any other investment product or vehicle. Roughly 24%, 25% of all investable assets in Canada are invested through mutual funds. Two-thirds of those are through trail commission paying mutual funds, roughly. 75% of invested assets are in other products. And any model that maintains trail commission is an incentive to refrain from using any of those other vehicles for clients. So I think it's really important that this debate be robustly engaged in. I do think you're absolutely right that any of these changes is going to be disruptive. We've seen significant disruption across the financial services sector for the last decade. I think that's what's giving rise to a concern by investors around conflicts more than ever. So again, thank you very much, and I'll turn it over to the other panelists.
Okay. Anyone want to go second? Nicole?
I can follow on to Warren's comments. When we're thinking about standardization of trailers, we are of the view that standardization is already in place. The trend is here. We cited some IFIC research in our fee letter that said that over 10 years ago, about 18% of equity and balanced funds paid over the 1% standard, whereas looking more recently into April this year, there's about just under 5% of funds that are paying over the 1%. And so, you know, standardization is well on its way, and we think it's on its way due to initiatives like Point of Sale and CRM2. And so our view would be to encourage increased disclosure and more awareness over the issue in order to bring the standardization to a close rather than a setting or a capping of the trend commissions.
So you're suggesting just to stay with the current initiatives and not take a definitive step?
Well, I think there's, you know, other definitive steps. You know, the third panel will be talking about, I believe, investor awareness and disclosure, and more awareness around this issue could bring further standardization.
Okay, thank you. Comments?
I would agree with Nicole that there is a lot of standardization already in the marketplace, and it's creeping in very quickly, perhaps as a result of the discussion that's been in the marketplace. And then your question to her was, should we do nothing or should we do other things? The reality is there are a lot of other aspects that we can pursue if we want to deal with these conflicts that I think the regulators are so concerned about. And I think our view would be that, yes, as the standardization has come into the marketplace, just allow that to happen, because it does seem to be working out very well. And I would also point out that the opening comments were about the embedded fee not working well for most people. While I agree there has been some evidence that it hasn't worked perfectly for everyone, I'm not sure we're prepared to agree yet that it hasn't worked out well for at least a lot of people in the Canadian marketplace. There is $1.4 trillion in mutual funds. Mm-hmm. A lot of customers use them, and they've used them very well. And that's changed a lot in the last 30 years. It wasn't always like that. Back before embedded fees, that didn't happen a lot. And a lot of people have captured a lot out of these equity markets in the last 30 years as a result of it. So we have to be very careful about tinkering with it.
Okay. Yeah, I strongly believe that it all comes down to choice for consumers. I think consumers need that choice, and there's different systems that we deal in a regulatory environment, and there's different product offerings from insurance products to bank-offered products to mutual funds to securities. There's no one regulator that looks after all of that, so it's very difficult to blow up one sector and get rid of embedded commissions when you're going to have it on another side. And our full view is that we need to support the choice of consumers, and I think that's the key by keeping that section until we come up with some better ways to handle it. And I do agree with standardization. I think we are going there. I agree with panelists. But I think, you know, if we have to get it there a little bit more quickly, that's not such a bad thing. We do believe that standardization is coming, and it's sort of becoming a self-regulating issue, and we want that to continue, because that will take the conflicts away, in our opinion. I think
it will take some
of them. Yes, and I don't think no matter what type of changes you make in a regulatory environment, it's going to get rid of conflicts completely. I think that's almost impossible. It's a goal, but you're still going to have some conflicts, I believe.
So, Neil, what do you think?
Well, first of all, I don't think I can usefully improve much on what Warren had to say on the subject. I think he did a very good job there, and the only thing I would add would be that neither standardization nor more disclosure will ever put the dollars that investors pay for advice under investors' control. And that's really what we should be driving at. Right now, under the current system, there's, as the consultation paper said, there's no alignment between the advice that investors get and the amount that they pay for it, on the one hand, and their investment advice needs and desires. So if we want to reach a point where investors have that level of control over the advice that they're paying for, we're not going to accomplish that simply by standardizing the price of the advice. If that price is higher than what they want to pay, and if that price represents a level of advice that they perhaps don't need, small investors in particular, while they come in all shapes and sizes, many of them have pretty straightforward financial circumstances, and they may not need a Cadillac suite of investment advice. So it would be best if they could tailor the draw on advice to meet their needs, and therefore we need a mechanism that will allow them to have that degree of control. I don't think we're going to get there just by standardization, and as the consultation paper indicated, and as Warren has done such a good job pointing out, we're not going to touch very many of the conflicts issues through standardization or capping.
So I think this is a good segue into our next question, where we're going to talk about advice gap and the cost of advice. It's consistently claimed that discontinuing trailing commissions would lead to an advice gap and a higher cost of advice for investors. So how will these alternatives of capping or standardizing lead to a better outcome for investors? Specifically, why will investors have greater access to advice and at a lower cost with capping or standardizing than they would with trailing commissions? And particularly with the mass market, where these would be investors who have investable assets of less than $100,000. How would this work? How would capping or standardizing improve the access of advice?
Well, I think I'll start off with that one. Mm-hmm. First of all, just a bit of background. I am an advisor, probably one of the few on the panel today, a few others maybe perhaps. And coming from that background, that experience, I deal with over 500 clients. There's 3,500 members in our organization that we represent, and they come from all parts, all walks of life, small cities, big cities, little towns, country villas. There's such a diversity out there that I think you if you're trying to get rid of a compensation system that pays them for giving advice, in terms of having it as part of the structure rather than having a smaller client have to come and write you a check for that advice, I think that's a very difficult path to go down. We believe that it's a better outcome for investors if they have that choice. If they want to deal with a smaller advice, perhaps, segment, they have options. They have do-it-yourself and investment options. They have ETF options. There's many options out there that investors have. And I think a good part of their ability to put their faith in us as advisors is sometimes knowing that I don't have to write you a check. I know it's part of what you do. It's part of how you operate. It's, I understand that you get paid for what you do, and I think that is clear. I don't think anyone doubts that if they have an advisor, that advisor is getting compensated in some way. So to have a trailing commission still part of that system, I believe, is very, very valuable, especially for the smaller investor. And it comes down to what we do as advisors for clients. We provide advice. We don't just provide advice on an investment product. We provide advice on their situation, their family, their history of where they've come from and where they want to go. We have to sit down with them and understand all of what they do. I'm just going to throw in an example. Last week I had a client, unfortunately, going through a divorce. Mass market client, $100,000 of investable assets. Now they have to split it up. I spent 6 hours with each of them to try to get them to understand what their financial situation is going to be in the future. And it's difficult. It's a task that takes time. And to say that there's no value in the advice channel, I think not necessarily that's what's being said here, but I don't think that getting rid of these trailer commissions is going to benefit those smaller clients. I think they're not going to write the check to the advisor. There'll probably be one of two areas they're going to go to. They're going to be pushed towards the banks, or they're going to get no advice. And that's our concern. Our concern is the no advice issue. We really think that they're going to be headed to that absolutely no advice.
So in this world of there are some products that have embedded commissions and some don't. What happens? If you're sitting with somebody who's in the $100,000 level, do you actually sometimes recommend that they go into non-trailer products? Because that's part of the issue with embedded fees, is that you then start looking just at the funds that have embedded fees.
One of the things that we do in our firm is we do both. So we have fee for service, and we also have the embedded commission route. And again, it's about choice. So we lay that out to the client and say, would you prefer to pay a fee, or would you prefer to have that embedded as part of the MER, and then which we explain the cost of doing business. I'd still say 80% of the people that are in that mass market still prefer that embedded commission. They understand they get paid. That's not an issue. But they just would have more of a difficult time writing a check to an advisor than a client that has a $500,000 plus of investable assets.
So you think the cost of advice and paying it separately will mean that they'll opt out?
I totally believe that, yeah. I think that'll push a lot of the mass market out to probably the no advice channel.
Okay.
And is that good for consumers?
Other comments on that?
I think the question is, how do these two solutions help? And relative to where we've been, I'm not sure if they do, but if they help preserve an embedded fee commission, then I do think they help preserve choice and advice for the lower end of the marketplace.
So just quickly on the not going to write the check piece, I don't disagree that that may be the outcome. I go back to whether the securities regulators have a mandate to get into price setting. I also think there are limits to the social policy remit of regulators as well. And if we think from a social policy perspective that it's important that all Canadians have access to advice, which I actually completely agree with, then I think we do that in a transparent and upfront way. Doing it sort of through the back door in a way that nobody really understands the cost, they know there are some, but they don't know what they are in many cases, is really not worthy of us. I think that if it's a sufficiently worthy social policy goal, we do it upfront, we raise money, we mandate the Canadians save, and we do just like many other markets do in retirement space and just like we do in healthcare space.
I just think that the CRM2 is the first step of that disclosure, and I think we're not against disclosure. We believe that there should be disclosure so that consumers are well informed about what they're paying for the advice they're getting. That's not the issue. It's more, if that advice has to come at a cost that they're not willing to pay, then they don't get advice.
But for many, they don't know, or they are kind of unaware of what they're paying.
Right.
And it did take 10 years to get CRM2 in because of all the kicking and screaming.
Well, one of our points is give that some time. I mean, we have clients now that look at a statement and what's this? They don't know what CRM2 is. It's an acronym.
It's a terrible acronym.
Yeah, exactly. So we have to discuss that with them. We have to have an openness. And I think that's the first step. The first step is have that open discussion, disclose compensation. We have no problem with that. It's a matter of getting rid of the whole system of how we get compensated and how clients can pay for advice. And we want that choice to still be there.
Nicole?
We also are a strong advocate for client choice. And in particular with respect to the mass market investor, just as an illustration, 60% of our accounts at Royal Mutual Funds Inc., which is our dealer in the branch, 60% of those accounts have $25,000 or less. Those are the balances. And 23% of those accounts are for individuals who are 60 years or over. So if we just assume, for an illustration that, that $25,000, that's $250 a year at a 1% trailing commission, for $250, we're asking investors now, instead of that being paid directly through the mutual fund fee, that you're going to now have to pay that directly, and we're going to have to find a way to do that either through debiting your bank account or, there's other proposals with respect to redeeming units of the mutual mm-hmm. fund to pay for that. The additional burden on that investor is now that they're also going to have to manage their tax deduction for that advice that they've received, which is, with an embedded commission, is already taken care of within the fund. It increases the barriers to that small market investor in investing.
Rob, do you want to say anything on this?
No.
So maybe I'll address something to Neil. If discontinuing embedded commissions leads to a loss of access of advice and higher costs for advice for those seeking it, how can this result be beneficial for investors?
Well, if you don't mind my saying, it's a mischievous question, because
it really says, do you think they're going to lose access to advice?
Well, yes. I mean, you're asking me to assume that it will. You're asking me to assume that an advice gap is an inevitable consequence of.
Well, I'd like to know your thoughts on whether you think that's correct.
No, I don't. I don't think that it is. I don't think that the evidence really shows that, certainly not in a conclusive way. There may be a reluctance to write the check, but that probably speaks more to a failure to advance a convincing value proposition to the client than anything else. If a client fully informed will still not write the check. But, if we are to assume for purposes of your question that we live in a world where advice can be economically and efficiently provided to an investor, for X dollars in trailing commissions each year, but for some reason that same advice can't possibly be provided economically to that same investor for that same X dollars if the dollars have to be paid by the investor rather than by a fund company. If we're to assume that that's the kind of world we live in, then your question is, in that world, are investors better off with a cap on those fees or with no cap? And intuitively, you'd think, well, the answer has to be that they'd be better off with a cap because that's better than nothing. But when you look at it from a functional perspective, I think actually the answer is that it makes no difference because the cap would make no functional difference. And here's why I say that. Presumably we're not talking about a cap at 25 basis points for an equity fund. Presumably.
Right, I mean, that would be a whole discussion on itself.
Yeah. I mean, I take it we're talking about something like 100 basis points for that fund. And at that level, that's not really moving the needle on fees from what we typically have right now. And as the consultation paper says, a cap wouldn't really address the conflicts issues very much. We'd still be left with a lot of the deficiencies that we have under the current system. So in that sense, from a functional perspective, a cap really wouldn't change the status quo. Alternatively, I suppose we could be looking at a cap that limits the maximum amount that could be paid overall for any holding via trailers or the maximum duration that trailers could be paid. And while that might, again, intuitively say to you that's bound to have some impact, we've got to remember that kind of a cap would bring with it a new risk, and that would be a risk that advisors would be incented to recommend switching as soon as a product reached its maximum payout point. And indeed, in that world that your question envisions, where supposedly access to advice could only be guaranteed through trailing commissions, the investor would have to, would be compelled to agree to make the switch, because otherwise they'd lose their access to that advice. So even though that kind of a cap might promise some benefit for investors, they wouldn't be able to capture it. So any way you slice it, under that functional analysis, a cap just isn't going to make any difference at all.
Okay. Any rebuttal to what Neil said?
Well, it seems to me that there's a view with some of my panelists that if you just do away with these embedded commission, all conflicts are resolved and there's a happier world on the other side. And you know, I'm with Scott. I don't think it just works that simply out there. I think if you remove these things, you involve a whole lot of other commission strategies that end up causing a lot of other conflicts that would then have to be dealt with, and would be back here in 10 years talking it through again.
Well, please not.
Yeah, please not.
Okay, one of the things that we heard was that a lot of stakeholders said that discontinuing trailing commissions will ensure that there's a loss of competition in the marketplace. So how will capping or standardizing the trailing commissions lessen those consequences? And specifically, how can these alternatives foster greater price competition or innovation in the market, or even product choice for investors? And second of all, what would the anticipated impact be of these alternatives on either the integrated firms or the independent firms? And Nicole has volunteered to be the first out of the gate with this.
Great. Thanks, Maureen. I just wanted to kick off the discussion with just a view on competition in the current market. There's ample evidence out there that we do have a efficient and highly competitive Canadian mutual fund market. With the existence of embedded commissions. Looking at the past 7 years or so, there's been over 1,300 mutual funds launched in the Canadian market. There have also been new entrants and new product developments in the market in the same time frame. And Canadian mutual funds have to compete with ETFs listed on both Canadian and U.S. exchanges, as well as other products and individual securities. And so I say that just to answer the question with respect to the alternatives, and we support the alternatives in the sense that they preserve client choice, and it currently supports dealer models that are out there, and there are various dealer models out there that rely on trailing commissions, and so we support it for that reason. And then another point on competition would be that with further standardization of trailing commissions, which we support, what that does is it does put the focus on competition on dealer service levels and fund performance. So we do think it focuses the competition away from the fee and on the value for service.
So what about in the integrated versus independent? Because integrated firms have a lot more ability to actually offer other incentives to sell certain products.
Yeah, and I can't speak to all vertically integrated firms. At RBC, we don't make any other payments other than trailing commissions to our related dealers. So our related dealers receive the same trailing commission that we would pay a third-party dealer. So I unfortunately can't speak to what impact it might have on other business models out there for vertically integrated firms.
So comments on that?
Well, I would agree that I don't think at the integrated firms it's going to do much in terms of changing the nature of competition. But I think if a standardized or a capped commission preserves the embedded structure, it does help for all of the independents maintain the number of independents that are in existence and the number of advisors that work at those independents, and therefore preserve competition and enhance service for investors that way.
Okay.
On the competition point, I guess, just to be clear, Canadian mutual funds are amongst the biggest users of ETFs. They're not competitors with ETFs. They're big users, and you certainly don't compete with ETFs in the non-fee-based channels. It's a pretty small area of competition.
Mm-hmm. So I've just got the 15 minutes left. I want to get the last question in. I want to preserve a chance for people to ask questions. So the next one is around unintended consequences. A lot of the letters talked about the potential that if we banned embedded commissions, that there would be severe unintended consequences. So how do we structure these particular alternatives to ensure that vertically integrated investment funds are still able to make internal transfer payments on a level playing field with independent advisors? How could we deal with that if we actually allowed for capping?
Well, I'll start on that. I think there are unintended consequences that would stream from standardizing or from capping, and I think, as was mentioned earlier, there's been a fair degree of flexibility so far that has allowed the manufacturers and the dealers to find paths forward with a great deal of flexibility. And if we impose rigidity in the system, we may not have that, and we may find that other structures become more attractive to advisors and would distract people from mutual funds, even if they're superior investments. So I do think we have to worry about that, but specifically your question is how do we use whichever alternatives are being discussed here to minimize the risks of those unintended consequences. And what I would say is I think capping is a whole lot better in that regard than standardizing. I think capping is far less rigid than standardizing, and nobody's really been specific about if we did standardize exactly at what price points we would. But any price point of standardization would open ourselves up, I think, to a lot of unintended consequences in the future, and capping would be the better way to go.
So capping or standardization, how do we, if we had a world where that continued, how can we encourage low-cost products into the marketplace? Because Canada is one of the jurisdictions that has a very low penetration of low-cost products.
Well, there are lots of low-cost products. That's a different question than penetration.
Mm-hmm.
The reality is I think low-cost products have been entering the marketplace at a pretty rapid rate. I think there is some take-up there, and I think if you just allow the trends in the marketplace to continue on, you will find a very good balance of both types of products in the marketplace.
Okay, any comments to those answers?
I would tend to agree with that. I think that as the industry is evolving itself with new disclosure issues and this discussion in general, I think that's good for fostering a self-regulatory environment where you'll see this capping or standardization come to fruition because of the competitive marketplace. There will be some consequences, there's no doubt, with any new system or new regime that's put into place, there will be some learning curves you have to go through, but I believe those can be worked out by the industry itself.
I guess I'm just puzzled or misunderstood the question, which I took to be how do either of these alternatives address and enhance the outcomes of those unintended consequences?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's been answered. I think we've been told that if we maintain trail commissions, we would prefer standard over capped and things like that. But I haven't read, nor yet today heard, any way in which these actually address those unintended consequences.
Mm-hmm. Neil?
Well, the unintended consequences that concern me really here are the consequences that would come from the regulatory approach to solving the problem. If the CSA turns away from using a comprehensive ban on trailing commissions and instead prefers a more piecemeal approach to the problem using, say, a cap and stitching together other targeted initiatives. The concern I have is with something that Warren touched on at the beginning, and that is that those initiatives will just add more regulatory burden to the industry. A lot of those initiatives will involve probably very, very intrusive and costly interventions, and ultimately the added cost that imposes on the industry get passed on to the consumer. So we would have the real risk that the approach of moving from a comprehensive ban CAPS and other targeted initiatives, could wind up burdening consumers with additional costs that would wash away all of the financial benefits that these initiatives are intended to provide them. And that would be kind of the mother of all unintended consequences. We'd have a situation where the regulatory initiative had subverted itself. We'd have the industry more burdened than it already is, and we'd have consumers, having no net benefit out of the whole thing. That would be a very sad end to this long-lasting, attempt to make progress. I really hope that that's not where we end up.
I think if you assume that the product is commoditized, then that could be a threat. But I think in terms of the advice that's provided and the cost of that advice, I think is sometimes missed in these discussions. It's very valuable for a client to have a discussion around not just their investment portfolio, but their insurance products, full financial planning approach that would take into account a lot of those issues that, yes, maybe there's a fee here that you have to pay in terms of a trailer commission, and that's embedded with the cost of the funds that are promoted. But if you look at the bigger picture, I think you've got clients that value your advice and are getting much more than just a high cost of a mutual fund trailer commission. So when you look at that, there's been discussions made that the value of the advice would actually add 1 or 2 percentage points more in terms of a value that a client would be receiving. And I think that has to be part of this discussion. It's very easy to commoditize and say it's just a product and that's all it is and it's just being sold. Well, that's not all it is. It's a full financial picture that you're trying to help Canadians with. And I think you're going to lose that, and one of these unintended consequences could be that you're going to lose some of that advice for those middle clients again. And we really believe in that choice issue. Give them the choice.
You're going to lose them because they won't pay?
They won't pay, exactly.
Okay, I think, so we have very different points of view on this panel, obviously. I think we're going to, now we've got about 10 minutes left, not quite. Let's get some questions that we get from the audience. Are there audience questions? Could someone pick up these cards? We have some. You have one that was pre-submitted?
I have a few that were pre-submitted while we gather these. And going forward, once you've got a quick question written out, just hold your hand up and we'll pick it up so that we're ready. The first question that I got over the internet from someone who's here today is that trailer fees look a lot like a guarantee of income to dealers and advisors. They get their 1% of the asset. In a low-rate return environment, how is it justifiable to pay that to an advisor or dealer on an ongoing basis when the investor may not be making much more than that on a gross fees basis?
Who would like to take that?
Well, I think, it goes back to that commoditization issue. If that's all we're doing, then, in a down market, it's tough for clients to see a fee come off and clients or advisors still get paid. But keep in mind, if you're a business person and you're running a practice, your main objective is to mitigate those losses, because that's how we get paid. We get paid on an asset-based accumulation of the clients that we serve. So if we're doing our job, and maybe this goes to more of a proficiency issue, we should be making sure that our clients' losses are mitigated. Now, you can't stop them because it's still market-based investing, so it's impossible to stop it. But certainly, if we're doing our job and acting in the best interest of the client, we can mitigate those losses, especially over time as a client ages and gets closer to retirement. They have to start to get more secure with their assets. We are paid based on what that asset value is. Mm-hmm. So if market drops 20%, our income drops 20%.
There's no question, and that's one of the issues that we know from this paper, is that people think that we don't believe advisors should be paid. Of course they should be paid. they're doing a service. But one of the main things that advisors do for their clients is, first of all, encourage them to save. And the second of all is to choose products that are appropriate for them, given their time of their life and what they're saving for. But there are those, and the research has shown that funds that pay more in trailers get sold more often. So there's obviously a disconnect there someplace. Put in a question card, please. Okay? There's a lot of research that has showed that, and some has showed the opposite. Next question.
Somebody has asked, if we were to move to a fee-for-service model, what sort of fees would you anticipate would be? So if somebody had a $100,000 hypothetical account, what do you think the fees would be? Would it be the same as the current embedded, or would it be different?
I think the marketplace is showing us so far that the pressure is towards the high side. I'm hearing a lot of 125s, 150s in these fee-based structures that are popping up as alternatives to mutual funds. And I'm not sure many of us think that's a good trend.
I would say in a market that is still dominated by commission-paid advice, that's the case. As it becomes more competitive, like in any market, those fees come down. You look across the world, you see that. I also think the challenge is that under either of these proposals, we're still proposing a flat fee regardless of all these different services. The client that Scott sees who's mid-divorce, who needs a lot of hand-holding and all that, he's going to pay just as much as the client who doesn't need anything particular that year. I think the move to fee-based will not necessarily lead to net higher costs. I think it will lead to much more differentiated costing depending on the nature of the service the client pursues.
Yeah, but what we have seen, though, is very standardized fees across the market right now. Do we have time for another question? Okay.
What do you hypothetically think that the minimum account size would be for a full service account? Would it move up from where it is today?
You mean at an integrated firm?
At an integrated firm.
Yeah, I can't see those advisors wanting to deal with customers at less than $250,000. I think there's lots of evidence in the marketplace right now that says they're all walking away from customers that have less than that.
I mean, that's a problem that exists today. Those minimums are going up while we live in a world of trail commission, so I don't think it's causative in any way.
Mm-hmm. That's something that was that we saw when we did the mystery shopping. It was clearly that certain channels only, there was a definite minimum to play in that channel. More questions?
Research shows that what retail investors value most in an advisor is transparency and an ability to trust them. How can a hidden fee ever be justified in the circumstances?
Well, I don't think it's not hidden with CRM2. There's disclosure now. So I think it opens up that discussion. It opens up a realm of knowledge that investors didn't have before, and I think that's a good thing. They have it now, but let's see how that plays out. Like, give that a year or 2 years to see how CRM2 and how advisors can start that discussion with their clients to say, here's how we get compensated. You know, and I agree, in the past it wasn't disclosed as much as it should have been. There's no question about that. And I think that's evolving and that's changing. And that goes to my point of let the market and the industry self-regulate a little bit and see how this plays out before we start implementing complete bans on commission.
Okay. Anyone want to respond to that as well?
I was just going to add, in addition to CRM2, the point of sale document actually has the trailing commission disclosed in dollars and cents. So, you know, it is a transparent fee in that way, which you may or may not get in a fee-based scenario.
But the disclosed fee still remains, right now, part of the cost of owning a product as opposed to, you know, a specific cost of getting the advice that the client perceives they need. So initiatives like CRM2, while they may bring more transparency, they don't change that dynamic. They don't change the tied nature of the the cost to the product as opposed to cost for advice. And it doesn't allow the consumer to tailor the advice component to their needs and their wishes. So, you know, while an initiative like CRM2 is great, we have to remember that that's not what it's built for.
I think one thing people are missing maybe in a bit of the discussion is new entrants, new advisors coming into the business. It's very difficult for an advisor to start in this business without some form of compensation that's fair. Mm-hmm. And it's very difficult to get a new client who you don't have a relationship with yet. It's a referral from someone perhaps. You're just starting to build your practice to get that person to say, yeah, well, I barely know you, but here's my check I'm going to write to you for X amount of dollars because of the advice you're going to give me. That's a tough one, right?
It's definitely, we know that a banning of embedded commissions will change the business model.
For sure.
You will not be able to build a practice from scratch without some help from the company that you work for.
Or existing advisors, existing independent advisors. Maybe there's a more focus should be put on transitioning businesses.
Well, but I think that's something that the business needs to think about.
Absolutely.
Because what's happened is there's been a reliance on the embedded commissions to generate new practice fees. Anything else?
If the CSA were to cap or standardize the commission, what would be the process for finding the appropriate rate, or do you have an idea about what it should be and why?
Maybe call the CRTC or somebody who knows. Actual rate, yeah.
It's definitely not in the DNA for regulators to do that in the securities business. That's right. Well, I think, how are we, Perry? We're done. I want to thank the entire panel. Obviously, we have people with very different backgrounds and very different views, and I want to thank them for being open and putting your views out. It's a very intimidating room here, and I want to thank you very much.